And so is that still considered part of the Abrahamic covenant? Because
well, in a way it could be, because the covenant is confirmed. Abraham and then Isaac and Jacob all get the confirmation of the covenant.
So
I think
it's
still the Abrahamic covenant, yeah. That's all the Abrahamic covenant.
So
Abraham,
Jesus
Isaac,
Christ.
And Jacob, yeah. In fact, there's several things stated. That, in fact, the whole thing was involving the covenant stated, and then its reconfirmation with Isaac and with Jacob and so forth. So it all is part of that same covenant.
I had thought back, and I specifically remembered it in this part, and
mm-hmm.
so I thought, well, that was
yeah, that's
from
what
Isaac
it.
To Jacob. And so I went back and...
It may be stated with the other two, but I can't think of it right offhand.
Mm-hmm. But it is still considered the
yeah,
Abrahamic covenant.
It's still the Abrahamic covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A question about your... evolution refuted class.
Yes.
For next semester. I just want to know kind of workflow involved.
Well, it's a class that it doesn't involve a lot of homework and so forth, because it's mostly just shelling out a lot of information that would be awful hard for anybody to find on their own anyway. So it'll involve a midterm and a final exam, and the rest is pretty much lectures. It's a lecture-oriented class, but it's information. You know, it's a college. Well, all of these are college-level classes, so you're kind of assuming. We get rather technical, but I don't give anything that I don't get background for. In other words, I don't assume that the person has any knowledge of
I'm
any
not worried about
technical field.
Technical
yeah, you'll have no trouble at all with it. Some people get a little intimidated with the things we bring, but I try to bring it in a way that everybody can understand, and then give enough meat for those that have got more background too. So.
I'm looking for a couple more. I'm taking the 20 right now. I got cut back.
They're probably, with your kind of background, they probably won't be a problem at all. A person that hasn't had much science probably spent a lot more hours in study preparing for tests, but that's about it. There's no assignment per se.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, I see. So you got the wrong
list. Yeah, I have to listen to a little bit more.
Okay. Sure, that's fine. You just make it up and just as long as you get the information.
I was sick last Monday night.
Okay.
So I made up all my tables.
Oh, there it is. Okay. I'll get you down here. That was it for all 3 hours? Okay. Good. Gotcha. Thank you. I think I did the right one. Sometimes I skip a line. Yeah, we got you. Okay, and did you want to sign for these other 2 hours too, Gene, or are you going to be?
Oh, yeah, I just...
Man, my fault. Okay, thank you. Okay. Continue here. I didn't hear the bell, did you?
Yeah.
Okay. Just too engrossed in something here. Okay, we're continuing here in Genesis 32. And verse 20, the big showdown is about to take place here between Esau and Jacob. And I talked about this word appease and the idea of covering the face of the person that's offended. It also came to be the usual word for atonement that's used, like in, for example, Leviticus 9:7. In the Old Testament, when you see the word atonement, the idea is the covering and trying to cover the offense. And of course, in the sense of atonement, it involves the blood and the covering of the blood, especially as the blood was sprinkled over the mercy seat to separate the one who's offended the law from the judgment of the law. And so the idea is derived from that. This isn't really a bribe on Jacob's part, but it's an expression of goodwill and conciliation. And he's trying to soften him, and he's trying to show his heart toward his brother. Verse 21. So went the present over before him, and himself lodged that night in the company. And he rose up that night and took his two wives and his two women servants and his 11 sons and passed over the ford Jabbok. Now, the ford Jabbok, this is the Hebrew literally means the ford of the Jabbok. In other words, the Jabbok was a river, and it was a river that, well, we don't have any maps real handy here, but the Jordan River runs up from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. About halfway down the Jordan River, the Jabbok River intersects it there and flows into it. So that's the river he's talking about here. And so it implies here that Jacob sent his family and his goods over and remained alone on the northern side for the night. So he rose up that night, took his two wives and so forth, and his 11 sons passed over the ford Jabbok, and the ford of the Jabbok River. And of course, the ford is a place where the river could be crossed. In other words, it was shallow enough and not turbulent, calm enough where they could cross. And so verse 23, he says he took them and sent them over the brook and sent over over that he had, and then he remains himself alone. So that's the implication there, verse 22 and verse 23. So he takes them all, sends them over the river, and he stays alone by himself on the other side. And there, here's one of the most interesting accounts in the Scriptures, verse 24, and Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. Now this is really a strange situation. Be all by himself now, and here a man comes and he's in a wrestling match. And this man was no man, as you'll see. It was God manifest in humanoid form. In fact, it's referred to as the angel of Yahweh, and which is Yahweh himself manifested in humanoid form. And so, and the reason we conclude that is from verse 30, and Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. So he didn't consider this any ordinary angel. And Hosea 12, verses 3 to 5, also later on in the prophets, referring back to the same event, makes it pretty clear again what the nature of it was. I think I'll just take a moment to read that. It's Hosea chapter 12, prophet Hosea chapter 12, verses 3 to 5, referring back to this now. Says, he's referring to Jacob now. It says, he took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God. Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spake with us, even the Lord God of hosts, the Lord is his memorial. So again, he refers to this angel that he wrestled with and had power and strength with God, it says, that there in that passage. So the same connection is being made. Now Jacob literally is wrestling with him, and he's crying and he's begging and so forth here also involved. And it wouldn't be long before Jacob sensed the divine nature of the man that he was wrestling with. That first he's just in a wrestling match, and who knows how it started, you know. He's laying down to go to bed at night or something, and this man jumps out of the bushes, and there he is wrestling, you know. We don't know how it began. It just says there he was wrestling with him. And Jacob was at a crisis point in his life, of course. He's at the point of returning to Canaan. Esau's on the way. He's thinking about his life. He's thinking about the promises that God has made. And once he senses that this is God that he's wrestling with, he's tenaciously hanging on. And he's hanging on to God for help. I mean, he's a man who's in a desperate position. And so in verse 25 we read, and when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh. And the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. Now, he saw that he prevailed not. This is referring to the angel now. The angel saw he prevailed not. He touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh. Now, obviously, God could have won the match. Jacob isn't going to beat up on God, you know. And even an angel, even an ordinary old angel, could have beat up on a man at any time he wanted to. So we find the angels that were at the tomb of Jesus grabbing that big stone, throwing it on the ground and sitting on it, you know, and defying the entire Roman Empire. They were not afraid of men at all. But God obviously wanted Jacob to prevail. He was looking for Jacob to prevail over him in this wrestling match. And this is a type of a spiritual struggle. It's a type of a struggle in prayer and in prevailing with God. And so, and this is what God desired. And but yet he touched the hollow of his thigh, and his thigh was out of joint. The angel imposed a physical injury upon him of some sort here, probably a dislocation of the ball and socket joint in the thigh, the way it's described here. And why do this? What's the reason for all of this? Well, there's several things that could be offered here as reasons. First, to show Jacob that God had only allowed him to prevail. All he had to do was touch the hollow of his thigh, and his thigh's out of joint. In other words, just a demonstration that if God wanted otherwise, Jacob wouldn't get anywhere. And so there's no undue presumption here. So Jacob isn't trotting off boasting that I wrestled with God and overcame him. You know, you don't find Jacob boasting that way. And he knows good and well that if he's prevailed, it's because God's allowed it. It's also to teach him a lesson that flesh cannot bring the victory. The spirit must prevail over the flesh. Just to show that his flesh wasn't sufficient. All he had to do was touch his flesh and his thigh was out of joint. That wasn't the area that he was prevailing. It was his tenacity. It was his desire to hang on. To hang on to God and prevail. So that's the thing that God was looking to. It wasn't his physical strength in his flesh. And we don't know for positive on this. Some feel that this limp that he had afterwards was permanent. In other words, for the rest of his life he carried this. If so, then the reality of his encounter with God and the blessings that were promised so forth would be with him the rest of his life, if he always had that limp as a result of it. That's something we can't prove for sure. It may have been only a temporary thing. But either way, it was demonstrating the power of God over man and the fact that the flesh cannot really prevail. And the fact that God is honoring and the fact that he prevails and yet his flesh is not hurt is a type of the way that we often are. As we prevail with God, our flesh is going to suffer. Our flesh is going to be limping. Our flesh is going to be crippled, and our spirit's going to be moving on with God. So it's a physical picture, but it's showing spiritual thing. Yes. Well, the only thing that I've been able to see is from it. Now, you can probably go into a lot more detail on this, but the thigh and the leg and so forth is in dealing with our walk, and it's dealing with our ability to carry ourselves, our ability to walk our own path and so forth. And we're seeing that damaged, as it were. We're seeing it made manifest that our walk isn't sufficient. This is a spiritual experience that's taking place here, you know, and what's happening is showing something spiritually. It would be perhaps analogous to the Apostle Paul's thorn in the flesh. You know, in other words, a demonstration that the flesh is insufficient in our own walk and our own strength in carrying ourselves. You see, especially for Jacob, Jacob had been relying upon himself to try to get the promises of God fulfilled through deceiving his brother into getting the birthright, and then later deceiving him when the time for the blessing came. He was always concerned about getting that thing, and he had the tendency of trying to do it in the flesh. And you're going to find his name is going to be changed from Jacob, the supplanter, to Israel, the one who prevails with God. And the prevailing is in the area of the spirit, not in the area of the flesh. And his flesh goes hobbling off, as it were, crippled, but he has prevailed spiritually, and he's a different man spiritually. Huh? Well, yeah, he's got that. See, that's the thing that God likes. God likes the fact that the man wants the promises of God. God doesn't like the fact that he tries to do it in the flesh. And so now he walks away having grabbed the heel in the spirit, as it were, but walking away crippled in the flesh. And that's something that we all need to learn, too, because it's so easy for men of God to want God's blessings so bad that they're willing to compromise in the flesh in order to bring them to pass. And there are times when God comes along and cripples a man in one way or another. In other words, as far as his flesh is concerned, he may go through some great trial, some great test. He may have a good portion of his people turn on him and come against him or something. He may have a number of calamities take place, and he might become a better man of God because of it. Dave Wilkerson has given some testimonies with regard to some things that the enemy has come against him with, and it's humbled him and broken him and brought him to certain positions in God. So this is what we're always going to be learning. We want to prevail with God, but we're going to see the flesh suffer as a result of it. Now verse 26, and you can see now the tenor, the nature of this. He says, and he said, let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me. So this was a rather long wrestling match. We don't know when it began, but he wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. It indicates a rather long match. And he says, let me go, the day breaketh, as if God has to leave now because the day's coming. Maybe he doesn't want anybody else to see him there wrestling or whatever. But he says, I will not let thee go except thou bless me. It showed that Jacob realized that he was not struggling with a mere man, because you don't wrestle with a man until he blesses you. Jacob was not overpowering a man either, but he was just clinging to him tenaciously, and he was, I'm not going to let you go except you bless me. Still grabbing the heel, as it were. Still grabbing hold. Verse 27, he said unto him, what is thy name? And he said, Jacob. Oh, God obviously knew his name, but he's setting something up here. Says, and he said, thy name shall be no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince thou hast power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. Now, obviously, again, this is no ordinary man he's wrestling with. You don't wrestle with a man and then have him turn to you and say, what's your name? And you say, Jacob, and then he says, I'm going to change your name. Your name's going to be Israel now. You know, how many of you have ever been in wrestling matches where the person attempted to change your name? This is God, you see. This is a supernatural and a spiritual circumstances taking place here. His name is going to be changed to Israel, which means prince with God or prevailed with God. Prince with God or prevailed with God. Hebrew can involve both of those ideas. And of course the idea is connected, because a prince is one who prevails and has authority and that type of thing. And he says, with God and with men. Jacob had wrestled with Esau in the womb. He'd taken the birthright and the blessing and so forth through craftiness and deception. He'd taken Laban's flocks with some maneuvering and so forth that God did honor. But now he's got power with God. And his power with God comes by losing, as it were. He's the one that walks away crippled, you know, but he prevails with God by hanging on. He didn't do anything but hang on to God and cry and supplicate and realize his own powerlessness. And he's not wanting to let go of God and his promises. That's the sense in which he's prevailing. Not that he's physically stronger than God. He didn't have him down in a hammer lock and say, you know, God, you know, bless me or give up. He's just hanging on, you see. He's just hanging on, and that's how he prevails. Okay, verse 29. And Jacob asked him, and said, tell me, I pray thee, thy name. And he said, wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name? And he blessed him there. Didn't answer the question, just blessed him. That pretty well answered the question. Jacob has had experiences with God already, we realize. He had that experience with the ladder, that vision and so forth. He knows God's name. But this is such a unique manifestation. It's so different than anything else he's experienced that he senses that this is God, but he asks and he wants more clarification. I mean, he's never heard of God coming and wrestling with people. And so you can imagine that this was a strange thing to him, and he's asking. And then the angel is saying, wherefore askest thou after my name? Seems to imply that Jacob should already know who he is and who his name is. And so then he blesses him. And there are other instances like that in the scriptures. John 14, for example, John 14, verses 8 and 9, where the disciples ask Jesus, show us the Father and sufficeth us. And he says, how long have I been with you, and yet thou hast not known me? It's as if he's surprised. They should have known already. And the angel acts as though Jacob should have known. And, of course, he did, because in the next verse he says, and Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen the face of seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. Peniel comes from the Hebrew word pan, which means face. So Peniel is face of God. So I've seen God face to face. So Peniel means face of God, face of God. So he had a close, intimate experience with God here. You wonder how he related this to anybody, or if he ever did afterwards. Now, what were you doing last night? I was wrestling with this angel and asking why, people asking him why he's limping. Okay, verse 31. And as he passed over Penuel, this is referring to the same place, the sun rose upon him and he halted upon his thigh. So the next day he's still limping. We don't know how long this continued. And he's now prepared to meet Esau. He's been strengthened by God, even though he's been weakened in the flesh. And he's had an experience with God that would, the sun rising is a type of victory and a new day and a new dawn beginning. And verse 32, therefore the children of Israel eat not the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh in the sinew that shank. So the Jews still don't eat this portion of the leg and so forth of lambs or whatever they're eating just because of this connection. Now, notice that God is not commanding this. God is saying, from now on, Jews don't do this. It's just a record of what the Jews did. They have a tendency to do things like this. Anything physical becomes very important to them, and they make a tradition of it. So God, this is not something God commanded, but it's something that Israel, the nation of Israel, did as a memorial of this important event. This word sinew, NAS translates it, the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh. It's probably the portion of the hind quarter containing the sciatic nerve and so forth, that portion of the body. So that's what the Jews have observed since to this day. There are things that Jews do today, you know, that are really amazing. They will not, the real Orthodox ones won't cook milk products and meat products in the same utensils. And you might wonder, where'd they get that from the scripture? Well, there was a scripture that said, do not see the kid in its mother's milk. In other words, it was an injunction against a very cruel practice that the heathen were doing, where they'd boil a baby lamb and so forth, or a goat or something, in the milk of its mother. And it just the practice was so revolting and cruel that God just said, don't do it. And so, but for that, they now conclude that dairy products and milk meat products can't be cooked in the same utensils. That's the way that's the spiritual truth that they got from that. It's really amazing. Okay, so a little bit more comments on typology before we move on. Jacob represents Christ in many respects, of course, as a type of Christ. And here his wrestling with God is a type of Christ prevailing with God in prayer as well. Jesus went through some strong agony and cryings and so forth. And he too received, especially with regard to Gethsemane, it wasn't just a halting on his thigh, but it was actual physical death, which other scriptures characterize as the bruising of the heel. Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7 is a good example of that. Hebrews 5, 7, also Luke 22, 44, talks about the agony in his prayer in the garden. Luke 22, 44. Also 2 Corinthians 13, 4. 2 Corinthians 13, 4. He was crucified through weakness and so forth. So he prevailed with prayer. It prevailed with God in prayer, but it cost him something. And the saints also, in prayer, prevailing with God, admitting their weaknesses, clinging to their only hope, Jesus Christ, clinging to their only hope in God is another beautiful type that we see here. And a few other scriptures, 2 Corinthians 12, verses 9 and 10, talking about the weakness of the flesh, 2 Corinthians 12, verses 9 and 10, Luke 21:36, to be shaking sleep and praying always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things. Also Luke 18:1, included with that. Okay, chapter 33. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men. And he divided the children unto Leah and unto Rachel and unto the two handmaids. So he's dividing up the children, verse 2, and he put handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost. So he's dividing them up, and he's giving maximum protection to those he loved the most. Notice he puts Rachel and Joseph. Benjamin hadn't been born yet, but Rachel and Joseph, Rachel was his favored wife. He puts the handmaids first, and then Leah, and then Rachel and her children to protect them. Again, getting prepared for battle, perhaps. Verse 3, and he passed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times, until he came near to his brother. This bowing was a customary action. The Tel El Amarna tablets, other ancient tablets the archaeologists have discovered, record that approaching a king, one always bowed 7 times. It was a customary thing before a king. And it was a token of respect and recognition of Esau as ruler of the region. And it's the way that Jacob is looking at him as if he were a king. And we find in Romans 12:18. Another exhortation, if it be possible, live peaceably with all men. And so he's trying to implement that principle, at least, back here. Verse 4, and Esau ran to meet him and embraced him, and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. So this is not the reaction that he had anticipated, but Esau also was overcome with joy, with love and joy at seeing Jacob again, and there's a reconciliation that takes place here between the two. Okay, verse 5, and he lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children, and said, Who are those with thee? And he said, the children which God hath graciously given thy servant. Then the handmaidens came near, and they and their children, and they bowed themselves. And Leah also with her children came near and bowed themselves. And after came Joseph near her, and Rachel, and they bowed themselves. These are all ones that Esau didn't know anything about. And he said, what meanest thou by all this drove which I met? And he said, these are to find grace in the sight of my Lord. These are referring to the gifts now that he had given unto him. Verse 9, and Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep that thou hast unto thyself. So Esau appreciated Jacob's generosity here, but he has great wealth by now. He has no need of the increased wealth here. And so he says, tells Jacob to keep it to himself. Verse 10, and Jacob said, nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand. For therefore have I seen thy face, as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. So Jacob doesn't want to take the gift back. He wants Esau to keep it. And according to custom, one seeking reconciliation can feel assured of it if the other party accepts a gift. See, it's important for them not only to give a gift, but to have the other party accept it. The other party accepting the gift is a testimony that they're accepting the person and accepting the reconciliation. So he's very concerned that even though Esau doesn't need it financially, he wants him to accept it anyway. And verse 11, take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. And he urged him, and he took it. Now notice that Esau had said earlier in verse 9, I have enough. And now Jacob says, I have enough. But the words are not the same in Hebrew. When Esau says, I have enough, that's what it means, I have enough. Or actually means, I have much, in verse 9. Esau says, I have much. Jacob says in verse 11, I have everything. In other words, he didn't have just much, but he had everything. And that's the way he was looking at it. Because both had been blessed materially. And Esau may have even had more materially than Jacob. We don't know. It's possible. But Jacob had the promises of God as well. That's the thing. That's why he said he has everything. He's got not only material blessings, but he's got the blessing of God upon his life. And so he has everything. He has no need of nothing. That's the way the Apostle Paul could talk. I have need of nothing. He knows how to abase and to abound, and all the time he has everything because he has God. He has eternal life, and that's again why the Christian can appreciate material wealth. But if he doesn't have it, he's still happy. He's got everything in Christ. Yes, question.
So do you think that Jacob feared his wife because of the fact that he didn't really want to anger God and he?
Well, I'm not so sure. I think more, it's just more of a human fear. You see, I don't think he believed that he was angering God by what he'd done, and facing, he knows that God wants him to go back to the land. And so he doesn't want to anger God by not obeying God, but by the same token, he's going to have to face Esau. And I think this fear of Esau is just remembering all the things that he'd done to Esau, and he knows that Esau's got a very valid and logical reason to be upset. So, I mean, that's the thing that's in his mind more than anything else. And he knows God's with him, but I don't think he's really fearing to displease God by having any hostility with Esau. He's already seen that God's blessed him rather than Esau and given him the promise, and his father gave him the blessing and so forth. So, and then God confirmed it later on. So I think that the real problem is his fear of Esau interfering with the plan of God. See, that's what his prayer was about. He was worried that Esau was going to kill him off and not be able to fulfill the call of God. So, yeah, I think he's looking at Esau as the enemy more. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that can happen to Christians too. We get, you know, we forget that God has everything under control. And we see the menace, we see the threats, and we become so fearful, you know, so concerned that we don't realize there's a place for prayer and there's a place for expressing it before God, but there's a time when you have to leave it in the hands of the Lord and continue to go your way and trust him to fulfill it. Because unless he builds the house, they labor in vain to build it. And we can be so afraid and so concerned about all the things that are going on, and concerned about what people are saying about us and so forth. We have to have a certain amount of concern. The Apostle Paul expresses a certain balance in this area. He's very concerned when false concepts are being circulated about himself that are going to hurt people and cause them to lose out with God. But he's not concerned a whit when lies are being circulated about him just out of maliciousness and so forth. He doesn't care what other people think of him, but he does care when somebody comes into one of the churches that he established and tries to undermine the people and to discredit his reputation because it's going to hurt the people. That's the thing that we need to keep in mind always, is to honor God and his word and his truth. And I think there's a mixture involved in Jacob. You know, there's a natural fear for his own life, and then there's the concern, a very pressing concern, that God's will may not be fulfilled. Okay, verse 14. Verse 12. We left off with verse... Wait a minute here. Yeah, verse 12. Okay. Okay, just want to pick up the right spot here. So he urged him, and he took it, verse 12, and he said, "Let us take our journey, and let us go, and I will go before thee." And verse 13, and he said unto him, "My Lord knoweth that the children are tender, and the flocks and the herds with young are with me, and if men should overdrive them in one day, all the flock will die." So Esau's band of armed men, you see, would be impatient with the slow pace that they'd have to follow. In other words, they were going to try to travel together, but it just wouldn't work out because Esau's got armed men that are, you know, they can travel fast. Jacob had children and flocks and so forth, would have to travel more slowly. And so it's not really going to work out. Verse 14, "Let my Lord, I pray thee, pass over before his servant, and I will lead on softly, according to the cattle that goeth before me, and the children that and the children be able to endure, until I come unto my Lord and unto Seir." So Jacob suggesting that Esau go ahead and not be detained and slowed down by the fact that they've got all the animals and the women and the children with them. Some feel that Jacob is saying that he will go directly to Seir, and therefore telling a lie because he doesn't turn out to do that. But it's more likely he's saying that he will visit Esau and Seir as soon as he settles in Canaan. In other words, he wanted to go and see his father in Canaan. And that he says, "I'm going to lead on softly, and then I'll come to see you in due time." The Bible does not record whether or not he ever paid this visit to Esau, but this is at least an expression of his intentions. And he may well have done it. It just wasn't something that was recorded. We don't know for sure. And it's not likely he's telling a lie here. He's just intending to come to see him, but he's got to see his father first. Verse 15, "And Esau said, Let me now leave with thee some of the folk that are with me. And he said, What needeth it? But let me find grace in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way unto Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth, and built him an house, and made booths for his cattle. Therefore the name of the place is called Succoth." The name Succoth, the word Succoth means booths. In Hebrew, it's the term that's used later on for the Feast of Tabernacles and so forth, the booths. It's probably the same place that's mentioned later in the time of Joshua. Joshua 13:27 refers to this place. Joshua 13:27. And at the time of Gideon, in verses 5 to 16. Judges 8, verses 5 to 16. The area would be located on the east of the Jordan, still on the east side of the Jordan, north of the Jabbok River, is the probable location of it. and was in a plain where there was a pasture for the flocks and where they could rest a while and regain their strength. So he wanted to get a time to rest and so forth. He's been through quite a crisis, and to rest, regain his strength, and prepare to move into the land. And Jacob built crude reed grass huts for the cattle and a simple house for himself there. These were temporary dwellings. These weren't permanent ones. And tried to establish themselves for a while there and gather themselves together, as it were, before they entered in. Verse 18 then, and their words pleased, got the wrong chapter here. Verse 18, and Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram and pitched his tent before the city. Okay, this word Shalem means peace in Hebrew, and most translators believe it should not be considered a proper name here, rather Jacob came in peace to the city of Shechem, because the city's name is Shechem. And Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem. Most translators feel it should be translated, and Jacob came in peace to Shechem, because he just had peace with Esau, you see, and that'd be the reason for that. So that might be a better translation in this respect. The word Salem and so forth was the name of the city of Jerusalem, and that's clearly not where he was here. So this was another small town with that name within the vicinity of this larger city, or it just means that Jacob came in peace to the city of Shechem. And it makes it a fulfillment of God's promise also. In chapter 28, verse 15, God had made promise with regard to him, and I think I'll just read that real quickly just to remind us of the exact wording of it. It says, and behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again to this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. And also chapter 31, verse 3, where God had made this command for him to get up and go and come back to the land. So now it's being fulfilled. So he's now crossed the Jordan, and he's in his first encampment in Canaan. And this is the same place that God had first appeared to Abraham as he entered into the land. Shechem, remember, chapter 12 of Genesis, verses 6 and 7. Genesis 12, verses 6 and 7. Now, this place, Shechem, is located on Mount Gerizim in what later became the territory of Ephraim when the tribes of Israel settled the land. And it was close to the city that would later be called Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. So this is near that area where Samaria later was the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. And Jacob should have gone straight to Bethel, just like he promised God. That was the place he should have gone. But instead, he lingers in Shechem. And as it turns out, he's going to wish he had never stayed there. The story of Dinah, one of his daughters, is going to be a tragedy that takes place there, and it would have been far better for them not to linger there in Shechem. So we read on, verse 19, and he bought a parcel of a field where he spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected there an altar and called it Elohe Israel. Okay, El Elohe Israel. This word Hamor, this is the Canaanite tribe, and this term Hamor is a reference to the Canaanite tribe, and the tribe is the Hivites. Hamor is the chief, and his son is Shechem. So Shechem is the individual we're going to be involved with here pretty soon. But Shechem is the name of the city, and it's also the name of an individual who's the son of Hamor, who's the king of the tribe of the Hivites. H-I-V-I-T-E-S, the Hivites. And we're not certain whether the city was named after him later or vice versa, whether the city was there and he was named after the city. That's a possibility here too. One more comment here. It says the parcel. There's much later in history we'll find that Joseph is buried in this parcel of land. Joseph was, of course, died in Egypt. They brought his body back into Canaan's land when they returned under Moses. And Joshua 24:32 records that they buried Joseph in this parcel of land. Joshua 24:32. It's possible he probably wouldn't have to have bought a parcel of land here to pitch his tents on, because if he had been farther away from the city, he probably wouldn't have had to buy one. So this is an indication that he was closer to the city, where property values and so forth were higher and that type of thing, where people wanted to be close to the city, and so he has to pay for the land. The money that he pays here, 100 pieces of money, the Hebrew is 100 kesitas, K-E-S-I-T-A-A-H-S. You always get into trouble when you're trying to estimate their money values. But one kesita is equivalent to about 4 shekels, so this is roughly about 400 shekels of silver. That's a very large sum of money, even for their time. Okay, and then, verse 20, he builds an altar, and that was a memorial of his return to Canaan as an Israel, the prince of God. He first come into the land here and erects an altar and as a memorial. He calls it El Elohe Israel. And the Hebrew, of course, is El, meaning God. Elohe is the construct form of Elohim, which means God of. God, the God of Israel, is what the Hebrew means. God, the God of Israel. And this is also the first recorded instance of Jacob using his new name, Israel. Now he's calling God the God of Israel, because his name has been changed now from Jacob to Israel, and this is the first time, at least, that he, the recorded time that he is using that new name. Okay, chapter 34. Now we have another unfortunate situation here. And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And so it's indicating her going out. Now she was a teenager at this time. The guesses at her age range from about 13 to about 16, so in that area. 13 to 16, roughly. And she's going about to see the daughters of the land. In other words, she's seeking companionship with those her own age. She's curious about the manners, the dress of the Canaanite girls of the area there. And the problem here is that Jacob has his family too close to this ungodly city. Remember what happened with Lot, camping there close to Sodom, and then pretty soon he finds himself actually within Sodom, actually in the city. And here Jacob is camping close to an ungodly city. And he's letting Dinah go out into this pagan town unescorted, apparently. And as we see what happens, we find the reason for the concern. Verse 2. When Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her. It shows you what kind of customs, what kind of attitude these people had. Of course, and this is part of the reason why later on, and it was just beginning here, but the Canaanites got a terrible reputation by the time that God drove them from the land. They went into all kinds of perversions. But he defiles her, and literally the Hebrew means he humbled her. New American Standard translates that he took her and lay with her by force, but the other translators don't take it quite in this sense. There's no real indication in the Hebrew that he forced her. It's possible that he might have, and in view of her age and so forth, he's certainly taken advantage of her. But apparently he did love her, at least, or at least felt something for her. Verse 3, it wasn't just a matter of just the animal lust alone. In verse 3, we see, and his soul clave unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel and spake kindly unto the damsel. So there's something in his heart, even though his conduct and so forth is not what would be approved. But in his society, it was probably very common. And it says he spake kindly to her. And if it was mere seduction and so forth, he probably would have cast her aside and despised her afterwards. But he tries to comfort her and assure her that he loved her and he would marry her and so forth. He even takes her into his home later on down in verse 26, we'll read. So he does have some feeling for her. Verse 4, and Shechem spake unto his father Hamor, saying, get me this damsel to wife. So he wants her for his wife. Now, sexual promiscuity was very common in the pagan towns at this time. And it was even part of their religious services. Their religious worship involved sexual promiscuity. And so that was pretty common to them. But even with that, a marriage had to be arranged by the parents. And so he comes to his parents wanting his father now to arrange a wedding. And it's interesting, too, that Hamor, his father, apparently thought nothing about what his son had just done. He gives him no rebuke. Doesn't, you know, admonish him about what he'd done and so forth. And he doesn't give up any apologies to Jacob and his sons, even though they know what the situation is. They're not making apologies and apologizing for his conduct or anything else. It just shows you the kind of a standard that they had. It's getting to be that way in this country today, where people who are, you know, living together outside of marriage and so forth, and people don't even make apologies for it anymore. It's just a commonly accepted thing. Whereas even just not too many years ago, it would have been considerably different, esteemed considerably differently. Verse 5, and Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were come. So Jacob finds out what's happened, and now he's going to actually commission his sons to bring vengeance here, and that's going to cause even more trouble. Jacob somehow heard, and no doubt he was shocked and angry, but he chose to do nothing until his sons came. And the question as to why would he wait? So whether it was just the remorse and the shame and being overcome with that, or was it indecision, or was it fear of the more numerous Hivites, afraid to take specific action? In any case, he should, as the leader of the clan, as it were, as the patriarch, he should have taken command of the situation himself. But instead, he relinquished the authority and the matter to his sons, and his sons had lots of zeal but no wisdom, And they go out and try to kill everybody in sight as a result of it. And then that gets even more repercussions. So let's see what happens here. Verse 6, "And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him." The word Hamor in the Hebrew means ass or he ass. In other words, it's kind of an unflattering name here for him, relating to the donkey. I don't know if in his language it meant the same thing or not. It'd be a very uncomplimentary name for parents to name their children. Here's the donkey, you know. So I don't know, but that's what his name means in Hebrew. That's the same word for donkey in Hebrew. Verse 7, "And the sons of Jacob came," there's certainly some typological connections here, "but the sons of Jacob came out of the field where they, when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very wroth, because they had wrought, he had wrought folly in Israel in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done." So they became very grieved, and this, of course, should be expected. They're not going to feel good about it, and Jacob should have been a little bit more careful here with the kind of situation he allowed to transpire here. And it says they wrought folly in Israel. NAS translates that they've done a disgraceful thing in Israel, and there was a disgraceful deed. And of course, Israel is referring to the nation, as it were, or big budding nation. They're all taking the name of Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel. So his family is the people of God, and this was a crime against the honor and the calling of Israel, and especially since it was committed by an uncircumcised heathen. They're very incensed as to what's taken place. So, verse 8, "And Hamor communed with them, saying, The soul of my son Shechem longeth for your daughter. I pray you give her to him to wife." So he's trying to make an arrangement here. Now, there's no word of apology or sympathy that's offered here. There's no suggestion that his son be punished in any way, merely a proposal of marriage. I suppose it is possible that he didn't know about the situation, but since everybody was talking about it so far, that's highly unlikely. So the sons of Jacob now come in on this conversation where he's trying to make a deal here for the marriage. And verse 9, "And make ye marriages with us, and give ye your daughters to us, and take our daughters unto you." So he wanted to generalize this even more. He proposes a general intermarrying between the people of Israel and those of Shechem. And that's, of course, exactly what God would not want, to have them start intermarrying with the Canaanites as soon as he gets into the land. So he's scheming, we'll find later on, he's scheming to try to assimilate those of Israel that are less numerous themselves and take over their possessions. And, of course, Jacob doesn't have many people, but he's got a lot of wealth, and he's trying to scheme to make them a part of their nation. And we see that in verse 23. You can take a peek ahead. "Shall not their cattle and their substance and every beast of theirs be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us." So that's something he's scheming. Verses 10 and 11. "And you shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade ye therein, and get you possessions therein. And Shechem said unto her father and to her brethren, Let me find grace in your eyes, and what ye shall say unto me I will give." So Shechem himself seems to have a little bit better character than his father. He really feels something for this gal, and he loves her, and he wants her, and he's got more honor than some of the others of the city. Verse 12, "Ask me never so much dowry and gift. I will give thee according as ye may say unto me, but give me the damsel to wife." So he's willing to pay anything, any kind of dowry and so forth. And he said this word never so much in the Old English might be better translated ever so much for us. "Ask me ever so much dowry and gift." In other words, whatever you want. Dowry and gift are mentioned here. The dowry was paid to the bride's parents and relatives, and the gift went to the bride herself. So the dowry was to recompense the parents for losing a daughter, and the gift was to go to the daughter to give her a good head start in setting up a family. So Shechem loves and wants Dinah, but Hamor wants Israel's possessions. He's got their Israel in mind and possessing their possessions, and his son just wants the daughter now. Verse 13, "And the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, deceitfully, and said, because he had defiled Dinah, their sister." So the sons of Jacob now are going to try to devise a plan, a scheme here, and they've got nothing but vengeance in their heart, wanting to get repayment. And the scheme that they're going to set up involves false use of religion. It involves deception and cruelty and murder, as you'll see. And perhaps some of Jacob's old ways are coming back to haunt him now in his sons, this kind of a scheming and so forth. And the poor example that he'd set earlier now is being seen in his sons. Verse 14, you'll see what they're doing. So and they said unto them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that that were a reproach unto us." A reproach, that is, they didn't want to, they wanted to make it sound as though they weren't willing to let their daughter marry an uncircumcised man, so They're going to try to talk them into getting circumcised. That was the whole point. And it's using the token of their covenant as a cloak for their scheme here. And this is really deplorable. They have no intention in trying to convert these Canaanites to the truth and get them circumcised because of conversion. But they just want them to get circumcised as a matter of course here to make no offense. And their real mind motive behind all of this is to get them debilitated through the circumcision so that they can come and attack them, as you'll see. Verse 15. But in this we will consent to you. If ye will be as we be, that every male of you be circumcised, then we will give our daughters unto you, and we will take your daughters unto us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. So it says, you get circumcised like we are, and then we'll have no problem intermarrying you, and so forth. Now, notice they're not saying anything about loving and serving Yahweh, but just being circumcised. If you'll just get circumcised, go through the outward with us, then everything will be okay. And it shows that their intention was not to convert them to the truth. This was all a pretense. Verse 17. But if you will not hearken unto us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we will be gone. And of course, this is a lie. What they're really intending to do is get them to be circumcised and try to bring vengeance. And of course, they never intended just to take their daughter and be gone and call it equal. They were trying to get vengeance. And of course, the scripture warns against doing evil that good may come. Romans 3:8, you can put down Romans 3:8. They're attempting to do evil because they feel that the motive is justified. And they should have really left the whole thing up to Jacob, who should have sought the wisdom of God in the matter in the first place, and recognized that the scripture says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord, and recognized that God got back at Laban for what he'd done and found a way to repay Jacob. If he would have come to the Lord with the whole matter, of course, things could have been considerably different. Verse 18, and their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So the young man deferred not to do the thing because he had delight in Jacob's daughter, and he was more honorable than all the house of his father. So Shechem himself, he was more than willing to do it. He deferred not to do it. In other words, there was no problem to him. And it says he was more honored than any of his father's house, or the Hebrew says more honored rather than honorable. It's stated to show the way the men of the city submitted to circumcision so willingly. Shechem was honored in the eyes of the rest of them. And, of course, his character seems to be a bit better than the rest of them, too. And so if he's going to do it, if he's the prince, then the others were going to do it as well. And so we find that others follow him in that. And, of course, the sons of Israel may have seen that he was in this position. He wants the daughter real bad, so he's likely to submit to it just because he wants her so bad. And the others may submit to it just because of their respect for him. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came unto the city gate of the city and communed with the men of their city, saying, these men are peaceable with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade therein, for the land, behold, it is large enough for them. And let us take their daughters to us for wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only herein will the men consent unto us for to dwell with us. Now, the gate of the city is where all the people can hear, so they're making a public announcement here to their people. So only herein will the men consent unto us to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male among us be circumcised, as they are circumcised. And so he says, shall not their cattle and their substance and every beast of theirs be ours? Only let us consent unto them, and they will dwell with us. So their motives are, at least his motive was, to gain wealth through this, and to him it's a small thing to be circumcised in order to gain this. And so, and unto Hamor and unto Shechem his son hearkened all that went out of the gate of the city. Every male was circumcised, and all that went out of the gate of the city. Okay, we've got a few minutes left here. Circumcision was something they had probably heard of before, even being pagans. Other nations also practiced circumcision, possibly borrowing it from Abraham and so forth. And, you know, lots of these heathen religions, if they find anything religious to do and anything that anybody else is doing religious, they'll adopt it. And so it may have been known by them by this time anyway. And they figured it was worth getting all of Israel's possessions and people and so forth in order to go through this. So, verse 25, and it came to pass on the third day when they were sore that the two sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. So their scheme was to get them all circumcised, and it's going to take a few days to recover. And so it was the third day they were sore. Now, although circumcision is a minor operation for infants, it's much more serious with adults, and it usually involves being in bed for 2 to 3 weeks, apparently, at least at that time. And the third day is especially critical, and fever generally accompanies it and so forth. So they were totally drained of energy. They were in a place of great vulnerability, in other words, to attack. That was the whole purpose behind the whole thing. And so they came upon them boldly, or they came upon them unawares and suddenly, surprise attacks, and they slew all the males. Mentioned Simeon and Levi. These were the two brothers of Dinah, of the same mother, full brothers. They were full brothers to Dinah, having the same mother, Leah. So they're the ones that are most concerned here. Reuben and Judah were also Dinah's full brothers. They were of Leah as well. And one wonders why they're not involved. We don't know for sure. We do find later on that Reuben was opposed to bloodshed. He didn't want Joseph later on to be killed like the other brethren did. And he kind of interceded for him. That's in Genesis 37:22. So he may have had a more sympathy and just not for shedding blood. And Judah was probably too honorable to be involved in the whole thing. We just don't see anything with reference to him at all. He apparently didn't want to get involved in all this. So Simeon and Levi, and of course they take their servants and others. They probably had their servants with them to help out, and went in and slew all the males of the city. Verse 26, and they slew Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went out. And the sons of Jacob came upon the slain and spoiled the city because they had defiled their sister. So they take spoils of the city as well, the rest of the sons. And it implies that some of the other sons took part in the sacking and plundering the city, whereas they didn't actually take part in the killing. Simeon and Levi did that. Verse 28, and they took their sheep and their oxen and their asses and that which was in the city and that which was in the field and all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives took they captive and spoiled even all that was in the house. This isn't the way Holy Ghost spiritual Christians ought to operate here. We're learning some good lessons typologically. But mentions the sheep and the oxen here in verse 28. And we find out later on in Genesis 49:6, you can put this as a cross-reference, Genesis 49:6, that in addition to taking all that they could, they crippled the cattle that they couldn't take with them. They hamstrung them, as it were. They crippled them. And you have to read the Hebrew in Genesis 49:6 to get that. The King James says dig down a wall. That's what King James says, but it's incorrect. The Hebrew has the idea of crippling the cattle. So there was a vengeful spirit. Not only did they took all that they could, the ones they didn't take, they crippled. So verse, and took all their wealth and little ones captive and so forth. Verse 30, I should say this, the little ones that he talks about here may not be children. Ellicott feels this refers to the servants. In other words, the ones that are little stature as far as the nation is concerned. Verse 30, and Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, ye have troubled me and made me to stink among the inhabitants of the land. That's quite a graphic expression. Among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and I being few in number, they shall gather themselves against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed in my house. So he's very upset at what Simeon and Levi have done. He knows what the repercussions of that could be. And he says, you may be distinct among the nations and so forth, among these people. It certainly reduced his reputation among them now. And again, he's very furious. He's afraid in the first place of the situations that surround him. Now he knows he's in real trouble. And he was silent earlier when he should have taken authority and should have handled the thing himself and prevented his sons from doing this. Now he speaks up when it's too late and the deed has already been done. Simeon and Levi, of course, felt justified in their deed, but it was totally wrong. It wasn't the way that God wanted this thing to be handled. But much of the blame has to go to Jacob. He left the matter in their hands, and now he's appalled by what they've done and how they handled it. Okay, we'll have to stop here. It's not a very pleasant note to stop on. I'm sure we'll get into more edifying things in the chapters to come here. We'll be going through chapters 35 and 36 fairly quickly, and then we'll be into chapter 37 and the story of Joseph, and that's going to take us through the rest of the book of Genesis. So we'll see how we do here, and then enter into next semester. So next week is our last session. We'll try to have those test papers back to you by that time, and we'll see most of you next semester, hopefully.